Good evening, everyone. I'm Naya Swami Asha, and we are working our way through Swami's Kriyananda's magnificent commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And we have made our way up to, in 30 classes, we're now at chapter 3, verse number 11, so that's where we'll start right now. Prajapati continued. Prajapati is God in the aspect of creator, who is talking to Arjuna. The voice of intuition speaks. You know, scripture is really remarkable. There was a long hiatus in the timing of these recordings because I was in Israel this being recorded in February 2020. I spent January of 2020 in Israel. It was my fourth trip there. Three of them have been almost within a year. That's really quite a lot. And I was leading tours. I led two pilgrimage tours. The first was for Americans, second for Indians. Here I am advertising it like this. They were really sort of, I don't want to say private, but they were sort of Ananda in-house tours. So what was the end of all of that? Oh, the end of all of that was the remarkable way in which God communicates with mankind. It's like it's the whole premise of the spiritual path is that the infinite power is present in the mundane, and that through these great masters, something happens that is completely out of the ordinary. And this has been the premise of my life since I was 18 years old, which was now quite a long time ago. But the nature of the divine is ever new. Master added that phrase to the classic definition, Satchitananda, ever existing, ever conscious. Master added ever new bliss, which is telling us how we can be blissful for eternity and not be bored. But the other side of ever new is because we are constantly expanding in our consciousness, hopefully. Let's say, as devotees, we are committed to constantly expanding our consciousness. And the chapter of the book that we're working in is called Directional Development. And the substance, the subject of all the verses that we're reading now is, where are we going? And so being in Israel, which now I'm more familiar with it than I was a year ago, but I don't know it as a country or as a place as well as I know some other places in the world. So there was still this element of discovery, incredible discovery, of how that there is a constant flow of inspiration from God coming to us. And we just, the flow is constant, but the opening within us gradually expands. So we have the impression that the flow is changing, but it's only that the opening within us keeps expanding, and therefore more of that flow can come in sheer quantity, and also more of the potential of that flow is visible to us. And then you have this remarkable story of the descent of avatars. At the end of Swami Kriyananda's life, he of course was brilliant, but brilliant doesn't even begin to express it, because his accomplishments and the quality of his accomplishments, literally, you literally can't conceive of how he did it. In fact, in 2012, I think it was, a year or two before he died, Swami actually drew up an affidavit that said, I actually did it all myself. He referenced Alfonso X, a king of Spain of some hundreds of years ago, of whom Swami believes he was a reincarnation, or he incarnated in that way. And Alfonso X was also extraordinarily productive, especially prolific in music. And historians later just pretend, or they just can't imagine how he could do it all himself, because most people create with the mind and the physical energy, And there is a sensation both of effort and of limitation. Whereas if you simply open that aperture to the infinite, then there is neither strain nor limitation. So Swami wrote an affidavit that said, yes, in fact, I did it all myself. I wrote all the music, I wrote all the books, I gave all the lectures. And then he had a few of us write little notes saying, yeah, I saw him, he did it all himself. It makes me giggle every time I think about it. But he was actually quite serious about it. He felt it was very important. And even more seriously, he said, in every note that I wrote and every word that I wrote and every word that I spoke was absolutely sincere. That's really quite a statement. What he meant was he never did anything for effect. He never allowed himself to be influenced by fads. He was never the slightest bit interested in winning people over by any means other than truth. He was simply in tune with the infinite, and he did what God asked him to do. That's quite something, you know, a lifetime of sincerity. That level of productivity, and every iota of it was sincere. These are what real values are made of. People kick around words like happiness, but happiness is the result of living in attunement. Attunement with oneself, with the divine, with truth. And that word sincerity, that word sincere is really an important word. Many of you have heard me say, and I don't mean this in any way to brag, because it might sound like that coming as I'm about to say it. Many years ago, like in the early 70s, Swami, I backed Swami into a corner. And he had to give me a compliment. Circumstances are not important, but I basically, it was tacky of me, but I did it. And so what he said to me was that I was quite sincere, which, because I had backed him into a corner and made him compliment me, I felt that I was being damned with faint praise, if that phrase is familiar, meaning that the best you can say is so puny. It's the same as being insulted. And I felt quite upset about it. And so a number of days later, when Swami perceived that I seemed to be in a mood, he asked me why, and I told him that I felt quite sad, that the best he could say about me was that I was sincere. It felt to me like a really sad thing to say. And it was very interesting because Swami was astonished. He just looked at me literally in astonishment. And then he said, Asha, sincerity is everything. Well, it wasn't so much that I felt he'd given me high praise. It's that he'd confused me. I just didn't know what to think about that. But over many years, I've really come, excuse me, I've really come to appreciate that, because what it means is that one is acting in conscious relationship to truth. And even if one is wrong, which oftentimes one is, me, for example, oftentimes one is wrong, speaking impersonally as if I wasn't here, oftentimes I am wrong. But never because of a deliberate effort to be false. To be blinded by delusion, oh my gosh, yes. To wonder later how I could possibly have really did or said that. But always sincerely, with the best effort that I have. So when Swami made that comment, that's quite something. Now I'm going back to someplace completely different, which is Prajapati continued. The God in the aspect of Creator is simply talking to Arjuna. I mean, this is Krishna's dialogue written by great sages. But here it is. I mean, this has been part of mankind's capacity to understand truth for hundreds and hundreds, literally thousands of years. People have been reading this because Prajapati spoke to Arjuna. And in speaking to Arjuna, he was speaking to all of us. Well, I'll keep going because this is precisely what these sections are about. Prajapati continued from stanza number 10, that's what he's continuing from. With this offering, commune with the devas, the shining angels, that they may commune also with you. Through such mutual communion, you will arrive at the highest good. And now Prajapati concludes, by communion with the devas, you will receive from them the earthly fulfillments you desire. He who enjoys the gifts of the gods without returning the offering of energy to them is verily a thief. Now, this chapter is called Directional Development. And what we're working with here is we're trying to get ourselves oriented in the right direction. I was listening to my friend Shivani, who's almost an exact peer of mine, chronologically and also in terms of her experience of Ananda. She's a couple of years ahead of me on both counts. And someone asked her a question. She's in India at the time that I'm recording this. She happens to be giving satsangs in India, although she's actually based in Italy, and she's an American. So there you have Ananda in a nutshell. Not that Shivani's a nutshell, but there you have Ananda. But in any case, she was talking about, now let me think why I was bringing her up. She was talking about how she came to Ananda, and she was talking about her desire to lead a meaningful life. In her case, she was going to be a lawyer, and then she was hoping to be a judge, and therefore bring truth and justice to the world. But as soon as she got to law school, she realized that really wasn't where her path was meant to be, and she went off in another route, which eventually led her to Ananda. But I was thinking about her and about me and a lot of us who came. Deep desire for a meaningful life. This phrase, you know, he who takes without offering energy back. You know, there's this intuitive realization that we're here for a purpose. And not everyone realizes that, I mean a higher purpose. That there's something deeply meaningful that we're meant to experience and that we're meant to share. And there's this problem of reincarnation. And this problem of not being able to consciously remember the world between our lives. And not being able consciously to see what happens, at least I can't see what happens when people transition. So there's this sort of little bit of confusion about where have we been, where are we going, where are we now. But one can sort of, I would call reverse engineer it. You can sort of look at, when you reach a certain stage of maturity, you can look back at your childhood and you can sort of watch how the energies were there. And I was just a truth seeker. If even from a tiny, even as a tiny person, just had this intense need to really understand and this, I was very observant and I didn't like hypocrisy. I didn't like intellectual dishonesty. I didn't like it when people twisted facts and reality to suit their selfish purposes. Of course, I wasn't always right. But it was this deep driving, but it wasn't, part of the confusion was that it wasn't merely that I wanted it for myself. I felt it was extremely important that whatever I had, I would be able to give back. But it's really quite confusing when you don't know what you have, or when you phrase it differently, when I don't have anything to give. And it was such a relief when I discovered Sanatana Dharma. It was like I exhaled, like I'd been holding my breath. I mean, I literally think of myself, and it's not that far from being true. Just sort of standing at the edge of the room, wondering what everybody else was so interested in. I mean, I move through life in a reasonable manner, but I always felt like I was just looking at it, and it was just, the whole picture was just a little tilted. And then when I read Vivekananda, which was the first Sanatana Dharma I read, there it was. It was just like I recognized it. I don't remember learning it. I remember loving his articulation, but I don't remember learning it. I just remember reading it, if you know what I mean. I recognized it. It's Smriti. But then there was still this terrible problem of how to give, because merely reading Vivekananda did not by any means make me wise. It just made me conscious of what it was that was, made me conscious of what wisdom was. But then I met Swami Kriyananda. And you see how perfectly aligned everything is? Swami Kriyananda himself was a yogi dedicated to serving the world. Master said to him, Swami said to Master, you know, I feel quite comfortable with the life of a hermit. And Master said, well, that's because you've lived it so many times. You know, the life where you serve, but you serve in solitude only with your consciousness. But Master, being the kind of avatar that he is, where he's always making things happen. I referred to Alfonso X was the son of Ferdinand III, whom Yogananda, we believe, was Yogananda himself. William the Conqueror was Yogananda himself, and Kriyananda was his son also in that lifetime. I mean, those are lifetimes in which the course of history of the planet is changed, but it's changed by intense activity. So there is this image in one's mind of the solitary yogi and just walking away from this world and letting it take care of itself. But there's also this reality of the necessity to always be giving back, to not just taking, but to give back. In the Festival of Light, which is the repeating ritual that Swami Kriyananda wrote, he wrote it about 1986. He received it, like everything he writes. And the idea is that in this 10 or 15 minute ritual, which is a lot of English words, well, of course, they're translated into Italian too, but I meant it's in the vernacular, it's in the vocabulary that people speak. It's not Sanskrit prayers, but in the vernacular, in whatever language people speak. He traces the four stages of the soul's evolution. First, we're manifested from God with a holy mission. Then we get caught up in the experience of the material world. And he tells it through the allegory of this bird, but this bird has this marvelous experience of feeling what he believes to be his own power. And he enjoys that feeling of his own power. And so he takes this idea that he actually has a holy mission here, and that he's supposed to gather riches and then share them with all, as we have shared with you, meaning as the power of spirit. Where does this life come from? I mean, see, that's the first question. Who am I? Where does this life come from? To whom does this life belong? The first stage of manifestation is that we recognize that we are a manifestation of God, sent out on a holy mission, which is to gather the power of the infinite and share it with all. Just as the infinite has given us life, we give life and wisdom and love to others. But then we begin to enjoy the feeling of what we think is our own power. We draw this little circle around ourselves, and we identify ourselves with that separateness, and we become proud and important in that separateness. Now, the interesting thing about the Festival of Light allegory is it says that the bird began to enjoy its own power, but it doesn't really work to separate yourself out like that, because it's fundamentally a false reality. It's one you're creating. The stage is called the revolt, because you are rebelling against that which is, declaring with your ego what you want to be true, and then suffering the consequences. And the irony of the bird's revolt is that he clung to that, even though repeatedly he lost everything he had. And that's us. We want to keep what is mine, what we think of as mine for myself, but we're behaving like a thief. So he who does not commune with higher levels of reality, and he who does not offer himself back in service to those higher levels of reality, is a thief. And the consequences of a thief is that you can't keep it because it's not yours. You know, it doesn't really belong to you. You get it under false pretenses, and sooner or later you lose it. That doesn't mean you lose it in one lifetime. You can watch people be thieves through a whole incarnation, and they seem to thrive because we don't see the longer pattern, even though repeatedly we lose everything we have. And what we really lose, you see, is our happiness, because we're not acting sincerely from who we actually know that we are. So here, God as the Creator is telling us, by communing with angelic beings, we become in tune with reality itself. And then he says, he gives us the gifts. From them we will receive the earthly fulfillments we desire, which is, I mean, there's many things that can be said. Much of this is quite esoteric, and so I'm not going to be able, I'm not capable of explaining it on levels that Swamiji could explain it. So I'll explain it as I understand it. God does not intend for us to be unhappy. I remember there was a period of time in my first decade of spiritual living when I just got myself really twisted. I did that on a number of occasions. And I just kept trying to be more and more conscientious until I just was projecting onto God all this narrow-minded, I don't know how to say it, just I was trying too hard. I wasn't really in tune. And I remember Swami saying to me, just the simple words, God does not necessarily want you to be unhappy. He said, it's you, that's your idea. That's your idea that you have to be confined and small and denied. Whereas Krishna says right here, if you commune with higher beings, then you will also have earthly fulfillments. But the earthly fulfillments won't be that important to you. It's just life goes on, but the point is giving, not getting. And so we're given what we need. I had a very interesting realization about Swami Kriyananda at one point, because in the early years of Ananda, when life was really, really simple for all of us, and we had very, very little on the material plane, I lived in this little, what we called them travel trailers, meaning it was the kind of trailer you could hook up on the back of a car or a truck and just pull somewhere and park in the woods. I mean, you know, they were like the size of a bedroom or a small bedroom. I was actually somewhere recently and I saw a trailer that looked pretty much like the one that I had lived in for a decade, and my goodness, it was small and ratty looking. At the time that I lived in it, one like it, I thought it was just absolutely wonderful, completely fulfilled all my needs. And at the same time that I and many of us were living like that, Swami had by no means a luxurious home. By no means. He had a dome that he built and furnished for a total of $5,000. So you can imagine it wasn't much. But it was a lot more than the rest of us had. He had a car, and he had equipment, and he had a recording studio. I mean, he had lots of things. He traveled a lot. But he was still living very simply, because he only had what he needed. And that's what simplicity is you just have what you need. And if what you need is to serve God, then you have what you need to serve God. And that's still simple, because it's simply who you are. Swami, of course, was operating at a much higher level of energy and a much greater capacity to serve than the rest of us were, but still everything he had was just exactly the right size for the aura and for the mission that he had. None of it was an end in itself. And it was all given to him in this world, because he was communing with higher beings all the time, master and angels, guardian angels, saints. All of these higher beings are there, and we're all working for the same project. And that project is our own salvation, which comes to us through the service of others. And this goes back to what I was talking about, the four stages of the soul's long journey that Swami talks about. We're sent out from God with a divine mission to be fruitful in the gifts we have given us, to expand and multiply them, and whatever we acquire, we share with all, because we are a part of all that is. There is no separate reality. Then we revolt, we rebel against that and enter the stage called the revolt, because it gives us a feeling of power to think that this is mine. But then repeatedly we lose everything we have, and gradually, over many, many lifetimes, we realize that there's something fundamentally wrong with the way I'm approaching this. And we enter the stage which is called the quest. And the quest only comes after a lot of suffering. Just repeatedly we lose everything we have, until gradually it occurs to us that maybe my whole approach is incorrect. So then we go on the quest and we begin to try to find out what's true, and then things like this come to us, and the New Testament and the Torah and all the great scriptures of the world. We begin to move in the world of saints and avatars, because those are the higher beings. And we begin to realize that my life is a gift, and it's not for me to keep, it's for me to pass on. And that's the third stage. And the fourth stage is to sacrifice everything for the sake of others, but to not consider it a sacrifice. It's directional, which is what this chapter is about. Because I was recently in Israel, and because I was in a position of communicating to two different large groups of people all about the meaning of the facts, the stories, and then the meaning of the life of Christ. And the life of Christ is just the most stunning almost that exists in the most, let me phrase it differently, the most blatant example of sacrificing for others. I mean, the whole of the life of Christ is this willingness to literally to die in order to open the doorway to salvation for others. There's many esoteric and other ways of saying it, but I had to just think about it constantly. You know, the willingness to lay down your life for your friends. Greater can no love be than this, Jesus himself said, than to lay down your life for your friends. In the Festival of Light it says, greater can no love be than this. From a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of others. And you say that, well, that's the great master. Such ever has been the sacrifice of the great masters for the world. But then the next line is, here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey. Now, not every soul becomes an avatar, because only some choose to return after liberation is obtained. But everyone, in order to be free, must recognize that there is no separate existence to protect, that my life, that I am a part of all that is. And if upliftment and joy is found there, there's no loss over here. And even the apparent sacrifice of a physical body or a degree of comfort or anything like this is absolutely no loss if it's done divinely inspired. And we talked the last time we were together in this series, I talked a lot about sacrifice, or in recent ones, so I'm not going to go there again. But sacrifice is simply offering the lesser into the greater. And sacrifice is not suffering. Sacrifice is self-offering. When Swami Kriyananda moved to India in 2003, I guess he was 77, I think, at that point, and He was not experiencing radiant health. He struggled a lot in the last years. Well, he actually, from childhood, he worked out a lot of karma through his body. And then as an adult man, he worked out a lot of everybody's karma through his body. And as soon as he moved to India in 2003, his body began to give him a great deal of trouble. And he was in the hospital in spring of 2004. He was in and out of the hospital. He was having congestive heart failure, which is, it's pretty serious. It doesn't mean your heart is going to stop. It means that your heart's congested and it's not working properly. And I remember I happened to be there visiting him. I happened to be in the hotel room and a sadhu walked in. I have no idea who he was. I never saw him before or afterwards. He expressed sympathy. And I just remember Swami so cheerfully looking at him. "Oh, don't worry about me," he said. "I'm just doing tapasya for the work in India, for Master's work, for my Guru's work in India. I'm just gathering energy by sacrificing my physical body so that many, many souls can be brought to God." Now Ananda has a very strong and beautiful, deeply rooted mission in India, bringing many souls who are devoted to Master's teaching closer to God realization. And I know it was the tapasya of Swami Kriyananda that helped create the magnetic field that's drawing all those people to a focus. I remember saying to Swami at a certain point in the years that he was there, I said, "Sir, it really doesn't matter what any of us do, because it's you who are planting the powerful roots of Sanatan Dharma for Master here." Swami sort of smiled and didn't answer me. But it was his magnetism, his sacrifice, that actually is the power that all of us are riding. And I don't mean that nobody's contributing. You have to understand this properly. But it's the ray that he planted there. And all this good is coming to countless generations of people from his willingness to put out that energy. Is that a sacrifice? You see how it all just depends on how you look at it. And if Swamiji, I think, had nothing spiritually to gain for himself, but if that kind of service to the world brings liberation for the individual, is that a sacrifice? You see how interesting it gets? And Swami talks about here, he talks about what we're always doing, the greatest transformation through the power of self-offering is not just what we do externally, but it's what we do internally, because it's the shift in consciousness that we're really always trying to work with. And that's what meditation is a complete withdrawal from the identification with the limited into an actual experience of the unlimited. And the practice of Kriya, the specific technique of Kriya, which is what Master brought to the West and what we all practice, is simply going in to that inner universe. And then consciously, what keeps us bound to this world is these levels of consciousness represented and concentrated through the chakras, where these commitments of energy committed to a material definition of reality from lifetimes of feeding that level of reality. So it's very difficult for us to escape. That's just, sometimes I have thoughts that I actually believe in other incarnations actually led me to madness, because I've had enough contact in this life with people who are slightly mentally unbalanced. I understand how it all works. And I have contact with them because I can relate to it. Where you just get too obsessed about some absolutely incomprehensible reality. And the inescapability of individual consciousness is definitely one of those. And the fact that I can go to sleep and completely lose connection with this one, presuming I'm not dreaming, or if I'm dreaming, I'm dreaming a reality that isn't this one. And yet as soon as I wake up, I'm back in this one. It's because the magnetism of the chakras holds my consciousness there. It can escape for a while in sleep, but as soon as I come back to wakefulness, those vibrations start again. And I identify with this body, and I remember my parents, and I remember my childhood, and I remember my responsibilities, and I remember the things I'm worried about, because my chakras are all vibrating on those dimensions of reality. But if we can withdraw the energy from that preoccupation, then we discover that it ceases to exist. I mean, we discover that in small ways all the time. If we worry about something and then realize we don't have to worry about it anymore, if we obsess about some past event and then just decide to put it behind us and not remember it anymore, it just ceases to exist, because it only exists as vibrations within our own awareness. So see, what we do in Kriya is we break that commitment. By the technique of Kriya, which is circulating conscious energy with willpower through each of the chakras, we create a dynamic flow of energy that ends up making our primary reality the spiritual eye. And what we especially do, see, all the chakras together result in ego identification. This is the medulla. This is individuality, the spiritual eye and the medulla. The spiritual eye is, I am a part of all that is. There is no individuality. I recognize that the life force that flows through me is the life force of the infinite. I mean, Swamiji is always suggesting that to us. You move your hand, and later on in these same commentaries he talks about this, you move your hand. Where does the energy to move that hand come from? I mean, does it come from the apple I had this afternoon? But how could I turn the apple into something that can move my hand? It's because we are part of this flow of energy, but we identify at the medulla, and then we have this individual identification. But individual awareness, that's Satchitananda, ever conscious. Being ever conscious is the nature of creation, but to be limited in that consciousness is the nature of Maya. So what we do is we transfer our identity from the medulla to the spiritual eye. And then we're still here. We're still aware, but we're aware of ourselves as we truly are. And what Kriya does is Kriya gathers the energy that's just spinning on this, what is actually a delusion, this Maya-imposed illusion of my separateness and my unique experience and my personal power and all these things. And that there's so much that's happening these days that is trying to go in the right direction but is limping along in delusion. I'm going to just digress for a minute, just because I was talking, I'm working in our school right now. We're doing our school play. Every year we do a big theatrical performance. I participate by helping to organize and arrange and make some, but mostly I just organize and arrange the costumes for all the children. In the course of that, I work with these kids. We have a kindergarten through eighth grade. And I was talking to one of the middle school children, and I was talking about my own little theatrical career, which was really only in school and just a little bit past. And I talked about the fact that because I was more naturally able to be an actress than some of the other children. When we were doing high school and after that productions, I usually got the character roles. I was the old woman or the villain or just something. I rarely got to play the ingenue. And in my last high school production, I was just tired of having to, wear the gray wig and paint on the old lady lines. And so I got to play the part of, Gwendolyn, in The Importance of Being Earnest. And Gwendolyn is just, it's a very witty play. But Gwendolyn is just the ingenue. She's very pretty. And so I remember, I was never glamorous as a young person. I remember three people spent about 2 hours on me, and by the end I was actually quite glamorous. And I got to wear the lavender organdy dress, and I mean, it was quite fun, because that was just never me, ever. So I'm telling this 12-year-old, who also gets to play the character parts, because it's a she, but she has a very strong personality and very strong presence, so she always plays the guys or the villains, and I told her about this. But her response was, "Good for you, you spoke up," like that. And I thought afterwards, my God, she's 12 years old and she's fighting all the time. Now, I understand, I do understand. I know that there's a cosmic shift and a necessary balance between patriarch and matriarch, a necessary an understanding of equality, willingness to be courageous, and all that. That's very important. But honestly, it really hurt my heart. Why do we have to be at war? You know, why think of it like that? Of course you speak up. You stand in your own truth. And you don't let people, you just stand in your own truth. But it doesn't have to be always looking for who's oppressing me. Because we are all part, you know, we are a part of all that is. And communing and cooperating, it's those vrittis, you see, that's where I'm coming back to. It's this material identification with this limitation which makes us so tense. I mean, we're all just so tense. I really think about my own life, and I think my tension just basically defines it. Because it takes so much energy to defend that individual self from the cosmos. And that's the weird part of spiritual growth, is that it's not this final perfection. It's this utter self-forgetfulness. Like, who cares? There's this story about, Swami would often tell it about some sadhu who came back to his ashram all sort of bloodied and bruised. And they said, "What happened to you?" He said, "Oh, the children were throwing stones and we had such a good time." And it didn't cross his mind that they were throwing stones at him. It's just they were throwing stones and having such a good time. And he was just observing that they were having a good time throwing stones because there was no self to protect. And that's what happens. We move from the medulla to the spiritual eye. So that when Jesus offers his body to be crucified, there's no self attached to that body. It's just this understanding that this body needs to be sacrificed. And then, of course, this body also needed to be resurrected, which is the real story, which is the transcendence of all of that. But the perfect willingness, this is going to serve, the perfect willingness of Swami Kriyananda to experience repeated episodes of congestive heart failure, because it's a sacrifice. He's gathering energy. Again, I've explained that one, so I won't say it again. It's tapasya. It gives us power. But the real power we want, the real sacrifice, as Swami said, is from the medulla to the spiritual eye. And that's the direction that we're always living. How can I be more a part of a greater universe and less confined in this tiny self? And that's where happiness comes from. That was the great, wondrous reality. I remember really catching it my second summer at Ananda. When I was living at Ananda Village, maybe it was the first, I was working in the kitchen of what is still the seclusion retreat. That time was also a lot of community members lived there. I cooked 3 meals a day for about 40 people, 6 days a week, and on the seventh day I drove this big truck into town, filled it with supplies, did everybody's laundry, you know, did like 20 loads of laundry, filled the truck with supplies and drove the big truck back. And in between, I was just busy. I was serving all the time. I absolutely loved it. And what I remember, I just remember a moment when somebody asked me something about myself. You know, it's interesting the moments that you recall. Somebody asked me something about myself, and I was actually startled to realize that there was a self to consider. Now, I don't want to exaggerate that. By no means was I in a state of samadhi. That was way beyond my capabilities. But my constant thought was the necessity to take care of all these people. I was acting, I was being fruitful, and I was multiplying. And I was just giving back because I didn't want to be a thief. And I was so happy to finally have something worthwhile to do. It was thrilling to me beyond everything. I finally had something worthwhile to do. And of course, cooking is worthwhile. I still feel that cooking is very worthwhile. But I was also serving my guru. And I was also helping to build something that I knew would serve for generations to come. And the fact that I was busy morning, noon, and night, it was pure joy. There wasn't the slightest sense of sacrifice. All right. Number 313. And this is about food, incidentally. Spiritually minded people offering up the food they eat to its source in divine energy, the higher beings, the devas, incur no sin. Those, however, who make no such offering, eating only for taste and pleasure, are verily feeding on sin. Oh my gosh, all of a sudden we're so concrete here. First of all, let me just talk about the word sin. Swamiji says at the end, sin means simply the error of ego affirmation. And that's just so beautiful, because we can't say that there is no such thing as wrong action, even though you can say that everything happens for the best and everything happens the way it's supposed to happen. But we're talking about directional development. And some actions take us in the right direction. Right direction meaning that direction which will lead to what our hearts really long for and will give us the fulfillment that we know is truly ours. And then there are actions that will simply lead us away from that. I mean, it's just as simple as that. And there's nothing eternal about sin, because a sin is a mistake, and the mistake will eventually be self-correcting. It won't necessarily be self-correcting in the immediate term, but it will be self-correcting in the long term. About the age of 18, when I discovered Sanatana Dharma, I also became extremely conscious of how to live in such a way as to be healthy. You know, and I just followed a lot of those regimens ever since. And I have, as a consequence, I believe, enjoyed good health because of karma. One enjoys good health. I'm not going to take credit. But it was many decades later that it occurred to me that my complete willingness to follow protocols that were health-inducing rather than in self-indulgent was because I've sinned in the past and I suffer the consequences. And that's simply what he's saying here. You know, it's permissible for yogis to enjoy their food, is how Swami puts it here. In fact, it was once expressed that enjoying good food is the last legitimate pleasure of the yogi. But good is also meaning healthful and in right proportion. Otherwise, one simply just weighs oneself down, and consciousness becomes ever more entrapped in material form. And consciousness trapped in material form is not ultimately going to give us anything that we really want to have. And so the realization that, the gift of physical sustenance and the capacity to turn a physical object into life force energy, where does all of this come from? And who is really responsible? I mean, we can study and learn how it happens. You know, I have a friend who's a doctor, and she knows things about the whole operation that I have no idea. But you're just observing it. You're not creating it. None of us are creating it. We are a part of a greater reality, and that acts through us. And the more we recognize that even the material gift, the material aspect of that is still spiritual. It's still just coming to us from God. Everything comes from God. The more directionally we celebrate everything that happens, Swamiji himself said, even as you enjoy a good meal, enjoy it with the joy of the heart. And realize that it's God's joy that I'm enjoying. Swami would comment that people would say that Master liked this, Master liked mangoes, Master liked curry, Master liked green coconuts. Swami said the fact of the reality is that Master was always in bliss. And so he didn't need a green coconut to bring him more bliss. But he had his personality that he played through. But what he enjoyed was the divine through it. And the more subtle we make our enjoyment, you see, the more subtle it becomes, the more universal it becomes. And so everything becomes a cause for celebration and enjoyment. And then also our tastes refine. Because if you're thinking lighter thoughts, then you want everything that comes through you to be lighter. And you just watch your tastes change. And it doesn't become a matter of having to discipline yourself. It becomes a punishment to do otherwise. Because we need that which matches our vibration. And error is to resist that upward moving energy and cling to the lower moving energy. Number 314. Creatures require nourishment from food. Food must be nourished by rain. Rain is sustained in turn by fire, heat from the sun, which causes bodies of water to evaporate, and heat is produced by the vibration of Om. Swamiji says here that the Gita is subtly suggesting the elemental stages of divine manifestation, which are in truth our entire sustenance, earth, water, and fire, and also air. And he talks about how all of these are manifestations of the Om. So this is all just the Gita talking to us about everything that we see in creation. If you look into it deeply enough, it will show you who and what it really is. And then he goes on to talk about the Om, Swami does. 315. Know this divine vibratory activity to have been produced by Brahma, the cosmic creative force. Yajna, or sacrificial self-offering, brings the great cycle of cosmic manifestation back at last to itself. So this is who we really are. And, you know, our spiritual path, let me think how to say this. You know, we're coming into very, very esoteric areas where Swamiji can write about, and I can only speak about it in the way that I experience it, which is not, you know, the full reality of Satchitananda. But I can speak to directional development. I guess that's really what I want to say here. I'll read number 316, which is the end of this chapter, and then I'll give a few more words before we're done. Whoever resists this great rotating cycle, living in sin, which is to say living in error, and preferring the ego-centered enjoyment of the senses, lives in vain. Now that's really quite a statement, isn't it? Whoever resists this great rotating cycle, and this great rotating cycle is that we were manifested from the infinite, and over the course of these many, many incarnations, all of this experience has really only one purpose, which is to tell us that we were never separate, that we were never isolated, we were never alone. I contemplate this, I meditate on this a great deal, and every so often, you know, the curtain of Maya just parts a little bit and we just feel it. Whether it happens, I recently spent, as I said, these almost a month or actually pretty much a month, in Israel, a lot of it in Jerusalem. We're drawn to certain places, I'm sure, because of past lives. Jerusalem is a place that I've only very, very recently discovered as some place, at least for the moment, that somewhat belongs to me. I felt this in Varanasi also really powerfully. I felt it, interestingly, in Gurgaon, where Swami first established the first ashram when he moved to India, especially the house we particularly had there. Maybe it was because it was Ananda's first house in India, but it felt like it was just a spot that belonged to me. But the city of Varanasi and the city of Jerusalem, both, it's like there's a feeling that I have in those places, both of those cities, where I don't have to live so densely on the material plane. I live here in Palo Alto, and have lived here for more than 30 years. I was riding my bicycle today, and I was having to cross El Camino. And I was thinking, this is not an environment that's conducive to human life. I was, of course, out on my bicycle, and it's easier when I'm inside my car. But I was also thinking, this is service. I live here for service, and I've been very happy living here. Very happy. I want to say that powerfully. Because this has been an environment in which I get to practice. I get to practice, what does it matter where I live? What does it matter if there's a busy street in front of me? What does it matter if there's apartments all around me? What does it matter if there's the noise of a train? Who am I? What difference does it make? Why do I have to always be thinking about me and what I want? You know, why? Where will happiness? That's sin, that's error. Now, of course, I have a lot of energy in my chakras that holds me there. But I have a deep commitment to break those ties. Because otherwise we live in vain. Otherwise we die as we were born. And what is the point of that? That was my tremendous fear as a child, that at the end of it I would be nowhere. I must have had a lot of disappointing lifetimes. In the end of it I would be nowhere, that I would have lived in vain. But once you know about the spiritual path, you don't even have to do it well. Because once that idea is there, that there is a way to live that is not an error, that is from all these scriptures, from all these saints, from all these masters, that the soul knows. That's what happened when I met Swamiji. It's like, I don't have to be good at this. I don't have to get liberated in this lifetime. But now I know there's a doorway. And once I put my feet on that path, I'll never be lost again. We will not live in vain. That's what the Gita tells us here. Don't live in error. Don't live in sin. Live for God. Don't resist the return to God. Don't resist it. Don't revolt. At least be on the quest. And then ultimately we'll be in freedom. God bless you.